Clerk? Thank you. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the I wish it were still August. I could get my list done. Welcome to the October 20th meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. If you would all please rise and join me in the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And Madam Clerk, if you would please read the changes to today's agenda.
The changes today is an amended item to consent, which is A1, a submittal of a resolution amending the tax exchange for annexation of property to the Oceano Community Services District, annexation number 5, 4th District, recommended approval and instruct chairperson assigned. Staff is recommending this item be amended by replacing the first page of the resolution to add language that identifies the resolution number that is being amended. The replacement page is attached for your approval. We have an added item to closed session, pending litigation. It is the intention of the board to meet in closed session concerning the following items: conference with legal counsel, existing litigation, formally initiated, San Luis Obispo County Flood Control and Water Conservation District versus Rywick Development Company, Incorporated et al. We have personnel. It is the intention of the board to meet in closed session to consider public employee annual performance evaluation for the position of county council. Requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement.
All right. Thank you very much. That brings us to our consent agenda. I don't have any requests to speak on consent. Seeing no one coming forward, we'll close it to the public. Bring it back to my colleagues to see if there are items to pull. Mr. Hill?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Shajian?
None, sir.
Mr. Patterson?
None this morning.
Mr. No. Meacham?
Yes, sir.
My goodness. I don't have any either. With that, then,
yes,
I don't
know. We approve the consent agenda items as presented.
Second.
And amended?
And amended.
All right. We have Mr. Shajian's motion, Mr. Meacham's second, and a roll call, please.
Mr. Shajian?
Aye.
Mr. Meacham?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Then we come to our presentation calendar. I'd entertain a motion. Thank you, Mr. Shajian.
Second.
And Mr. Meacham, again, another roll call, please.
Mr. Shajian?
Aye.
Mr. Meacham?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Our first presentation is a resolution designating October 2009 as San Luis Obispo County Domestic Violence Awareness Month. I have been working with the DA on this, and I don't immediately see Mr. Shea. If we could have perhaps a representative of the, or she's going to, yeah, a representative go and corral him. Mr. Shea caucusing with his committee in the lobby there.
We need the witnesses.
Yeah, so we'll ask Mr. Shea and representatives of the Women's Shelter Program to come forward, please. Good morning. The following resolution is hereby offered and read. Whereas a person's home should be a place of warmth, tranquility, and security, and for most of us, home and family can indeed be counted among our greatest blessings. And whereas our county's women's shelters provide a variety of preventative and direct services, including over 8,800 nights of shelter to domestic violence victims last year, with over 60% of these shelter nights provided to children. And whereas domestic violence continues to be a major national public health problem, affecting nearly 4 million victims each year among U.S. women ages 18 and older, with an estimated 3.3 million children witnessing domestic violence in their homes each year. And whereas approximately a quarter of all crime victims served by the San Luis Obispo County District Attorney, Victim Witness Center, are victims of domestic violence. And whereas the county's Domestic Violence Task Force has been a major ally in directly confronting the problem of domestic violence by interagency collaboration and engaging in prevention and intervention efforts. And whereas we must join together in our commitment to addressing the behaviors and causes of this crime so that each and every home can be a place of peace and safety, now therefore be it resolved that the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors designates October 2009 as San Luis Obispo County Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Mr. Shea, if you would.
Good morning, Jerry Shea, District Attorney. Thank you very much for this proclamation declaring the month of October as Domestic Violence Awareness Month. I think it's a really important proclamation, particularly because of the fact that it sends a message to the people here today, to the people who are listening on the radio, to the people who may watch this program on television later this week, that domestic violence is indeed a serious crime. It's a crime that occurs frequently in this county. Just the fact that you've noticed all the different bed nights in the county that need to be used at domestic violence shelters is evidence of that. But I think it's also important to note that there's help. There's hope. And for those people who are in the anguish of domestic violence, there are various centers that they can go to get that kind of help. In particular, for immediate emergency shelter in the North County Women's Shelter can be reached at phone number 461-1338. And for emergency domestic violence needs south of the grade, I guess the Women's Shelter in San Luis Obispo can be contacted at 781-6400. Or in either case, the hotline of 211 can be used to contact the Women's Shelter in either the north or the south county. So I think this is a particularly important thing that you're doing today as a board to recognize domestic violence awareness for October, and I think it's particularly important that we get the word out. In so doing, the Women's Shelter Program of San Luis Obispo, in conjunction with Domestic Violence Awareness Month in October, it has put together a new campaign, a Safe Place sticker campaign, and here to briefly explain that campaign is Sarah Oh, who is the who's an AmeriCorps member and the shelter's prevention coordinator. Sarah?
Hi, thanks so much for having us here today. So one of the projects under my care at the Women's Shelter Program is something we've been calling the Safe Place Sticker Campaign. And what that is we have these stickers that we have been mailing out asking businesses around San Luis Obispo County to place up in their businesses, whether that be a law office or a doctor's office or a coffee shop that's in San Luis Obispo. And it's an updated version of the Safe Haven campaign, if you've seen those stickers up in San Luis Obispo. And all it says, it's a very simple concept, that if you are a victim of intimate partner violence or domestic violence, that you can use our phone during your business hours to call SLOW Hotline, which is 211, or our Women's Shelter Program's Daytime Crisis Line, which is 781-6400. And so creates a safe place, creates many safe places, hopefully in San Luis Obispo County, where victims of intimate partner violence can use their phone to contact someone to get into a safe place. So we've had a lot of support thus far. We've probably given out around 100 stickers already. And so, we thank San Luis Obispo County for their support, and thank you for allowing us to speak about it today. Ms. Beth.
Good morning. I want to thank you for your continued support and all these years. We've been in the county for 30 years. Oh, by the way, I'm Beth Robb. I'm from the Women's Shelter Program in San Luis Obispo. I'm the Director of Outreach and Volunteers. And I also wanted to point out today that in your hallway, right outside your offices here, we do have our awareness display, and we had two artists, Patricia Gundert and Jenny Kompolt, put together some art pieces about domestic violence and calling for peace in the home, because that's really what our goal is, to create a safe place and call for peace in the home. So feel free to afterwards go look at the displays with the Tribune excerpts, and just thank you for your support in this county.
Just in conclusion, if the board's agreeable, I'd be happy to coordinate with the board with regard to a memo to go out to the department heads with regard to the Safe Sticker Program, as well as sending out the stickers. So if the board's agreeable, I'd be happy to do that.
I can be virtually assured we have consensus across the dais here. It's something that Mr. Shea and I had talked about, and I don't know if the camera can get in close. That's the sticker, smallish purple sticker with Women's Shelter Program at the top. We would certainly like the community to know that any county building is a safe place, a place where someone who's a victim of domestic violence can come to make a confidential phone call. So we would like to work with all departments to, alert our employees to post the sticker where it's appropriate and to be there as a resource to get folks connected with help when they need it.
Great. I'd be happy to coordinate that with you.
Great. Appreciate that, Mr. Shea. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Our second presentation of the morning are our 20-year service awards, and our HR director, Ms. Douglas Schatz, will lead that part of the program. Tammy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I'm Tammy Douglas Schatz, and here with me today is Dory Duke from the Human Resources Department. We are happy to be here to assist the board in your tradition of recognizing employees for their years of public service. Individuals recognized by the board are dedicated employees who serve as an example to others as they contribute on a daily basis to the county's vision of a safe, healthy, livable, prosperous, and well-governed community. We have 13 awards we're presenting today for 20 years of service. So what we'll do is we'll call your name, and if you could come up and Dory will give you your award, then you can line up and receive congratulations from the board, and we'll take one big group picture. So first we'd like to honor James Courtney from Air Pollution Control District. James began his career as an air quality specialist, too, and is still serving in that capacity. Next, we'd like to honor Karen Brooks, also from Air Pollution Control. Karen also started her career as an air quality specialist and is now a supervising air quality specialist. Okay, next, we'd like to honor Holly Morgan from the Auditor Controller. Holly started her career as an intermediate typist clerk and is now an administrative service officer, too. Okay, next, we'd like to honor Sandra Mitchell from the District Attorney. Sandra began her career as a Deputy District Attorney 2 and is now a Deputy District Attorney 4. Okay, next, help me recognize Natalie Reed from the Drinking Driver Programs. Natalie began her career as an intermediate typist clerk and is now an administrative assistant 3. Okay, next we're recognizing David Jones from the General Services Agency Golf Courses. And David has served as a greenskeeper during his career. Next, we'd like to recognize Elaine Jordison from Mental Health. Elaine began her career as an intermediate typist clerk and is now a senior medical records technician. Okay, next we'd like to honor Stephanie Buckler from Mental Health. Buchler, I apologize. Thank you. Stephanie began her career as a mental health therapist 4 and still serves in that capacity. Thank you. Next, we'd like to honor Marie Cowan from the Planning Department. Yeah. Marie began her career as an animal control aide and is now a resource protection specialist. Next, we'd like to recognize James Caruso, also from the Planning Department. James began his career as an associate planner.
Yankee fan.
James is now a senior planner.
Almost got a button-down shirt on him.
Next, let's honor Mark Hutchinson from the Public Works Department. Mark began his career as an environmental specialist one and is now an environmental division manager. Next, we'll honor Lance Hilsinger from Social Services. Lance has served as a social worker for during his career. And finally, today we'd like to recognize Alice Rackley, also from Social Services. Alice began her career as a mail clerk and is now a senior account clerk. Now, can we get a huge picture with a wide angle lens?
You have a camera.
I'll chip in and buy Caruso a button-down shirt.
Come on! Oh,
we're one big family here.
There we go.
That's right. Wait a minute, you're a professional. You're supposed to.
Another 20 years in her career.
All right.
Oh, wow.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of my colleagues and the residents of the county, we do thank you for over 2.5 centuries of service to our residents. And appreciate your attendance here.
I have some sky calls.
We'll let the room clear. Whether it's a variety of our presentations this morning that's thinned the crowd somewhat, but we'll hang in. First, going to our period for general public comment items not on the agenda. I have a few requests to speak here. We'll start with Eric Greening, followed by Andy Pease.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Eric Greening, and I'm not formally a part of the folks I'm sitting with, but I very much support what they're going to say, and I do hope everyone shows up at the Sunken Gardens in Atascadero this Saturday relative to our goal for forestalling and reducing the greenhouse gas emissions to the extent that the climate doesn't change catastrophically. It's already changing, and we're very thankful for what we received, even if it was an out-of-season typhoon. It's gotten things green and the creeks flowing, but climate change in general is pretty treacherous business. Anyway, I wanted to raise a couple of other issues. There is recent news of a federal court decision that once again told the legislature they were breaking the law. This one was relative to in-home supportive services, where the cuts were going to be absolutely draconian and were going to take place November 1st. Mr. Collins gave a very compelling presentation at the Area Agency on Aging not long ago about the extent of the damage those cuts would have done, where people who were basically not able to care for themselves would no longer have groceries brought in or their homes kept up or their food cooked unless people did it on their own time, that their paid workers would only be paid for time they were giving direct physical care. I understand that now this federal court decision is hopefully going to restore some of that, although knowing how the legislature reacted to court decisions on public transit, they may be defiant. I don't know how they can appeal a federal court decision the way they did the local court decisions on transit. But what I'm leading up to is, given the different pathways through which the legislature is being called to account and told to obey the law, I think we are overdue for a briefing on the current impacts in the county of what's happening both on the court side and on the legislative side, and any reconfiguring of our legislative platform that we may need to do to keep up with changed circumstances. Obviously, this would be best scheduled if Don Peterson was available, because we always have an incredible benefit of his deep knowledge and experience there. But I just hope this gets on our radar screen. We've got several special sessions coming up in the fall, one of which on water could be very, very critical as well. And so it's good to just keep abreast of the dizzying changes. But if nothing else, we need to be sure to hold our representatives in Sacramento to the laws that they swore to uphold. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Ms. Pease, followed by Polly Cooper.
Good morning. I'm Andy Pease. I'm here on behalf of Slow Green Build, your local nonprofit dedicated to advocacy and education for green building. Slow Green Build has a program to recognize green building. Green buildings are buildings that are energy efficient, use resources in a responsible way, whether it's materials or water or land, and have healthy indoor environments. We're very honored today to be able to present a certificate of recognition for Congregation Beth David. It's a project I'm sure you've all been familiar with. It's been a terrific asset to our entire community. The building itself is passive solar, it has straw bale, it has a very low water use, has wonderful indoor air quality, it has really innovative ways to keep the building cool and comfortable and healthy inside. It's the first project in our county to earn LEED certification. LEED is the Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, a program by the U.S. Green Building Council, and so we're thrilled to have that project. They're also the first LEED certified synagogue in the world. So it's a very impressive project, very innovative. The architect is San Luis Sustainability Group, and here to accept the award on behalf of Congregation Beth David is Paul Wolf.
And Bob Wolf.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. On behalf of the over 200 families at our congregation, Beth David, I want to sincerely thank the Green Built, Slow Green Built, for the considerable honor of this certificate. And we shall be very proud to mount it directly very close to the LEED certificate that we have in the building. The success of this endeavor is due to the outstanding collaboration between the three major players of this enterprise, which was the architects, the clients. The architects are here, the San Luis Obispo Sustainability Group, the clients, and the builder, the Defferville Construction Company of Santa Maria, and Madrone Landscaping, of San Luis Obispo. And all were on the same page and cooperated very, very closely on this. And Bob Wolf and I are representing the client and the user. We found that being in a sustainable building has a remarkable effect on the users, congregants, visitors, even custodians in the overflow homeless population that we house every August appreciate the building and ask questions about it and learn about sustainability. And people are becoming very inspired to consider the judicious use of energy in their own lives. We've started a Green Shalom movement that promotes the use of green, fair trade, and organic products. Again, my time is up, and again, my thanks to the Slow Green Build, but also to the Slow Sustainability Group and Deferable Construction. And the Sustainability Group has a few comments that they'd like to make. Three representatives of the architects are here.
In fact, our next speaker is Cooper from the Sustainability Group.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, we're delighted to have this kind of a client who's smart enough to demand a building that's beautiful but also works. And it's not rocket science. It's something that's easy to do. And it makes a whole lot of difference to the congregation. They've saved $30,000 for the first year, $30,000 for the second year, $30,000 for the third year of their being in this building that doesn't require the kind of energy that a, quote, conventional building needs to be habitable and comfortable. And so they've recovered their architectural fees in 3 years
almost of
inhabiting this building. So it's just a message to all enlightened clients out there that you can demand quality and get it and do a great thing for the environment and have a terrific building at the same time. So thanks for faith in our design abilities, the CBD.
We chose well.
Yes, you did.
You want to stand there with it?
I'll just mention, you all know what a wonderful building it is, of course, and it should be mentioned perhaps that there's sort of two parts to the process of becoming LEED certified. The first is that you have to have a building or project that is worthy of it, and clearly in this case it is. The other part is a pretty lengthy and involved, you know, process of certification and paperwork and you know, documentation. The normal thing to do to obtain LEED certification is to hire a professional for $10,000 or $20,000 to do that process. And we showed that a fairly dedicated and bullheaded group of four or five volunteers could accomplish that and show that, you know, that it can be done on a volunteer basis with a lot of grunt work. And as I said, a group of maybe 4 to 6 people were able to do the most of the, with some help from the professionals, of course, we were able to get through that certification process. So we're all very happy about it. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for coming down and filling us in on that. We appreciate it. Congratulations to the synagogue. Mr. Patterson?
Thank you. Yes, I just wanted to thank Slow Green Build and the congregation, Beth David, and all of those that participated in creating this building. We know that our built environment is a significant contributor to greenhouse gases, and we know that there is a viable alternative to doing it differently, and we're all beginning to focus on that. In fact, the county is taking measures now to make the opportunity available through public financing so people can retrofit their homes and use renewable energy technologies to make their lives more comfortable, less expensive in the long run, reduce their fossil fuel consumption and reduce their greenhouse gas contributions. And it's great that you've shown the leadership and set the example for a way that we can do it differently. And thank you all very much.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if you want to line up here and take a picture with us, you're welcome to do so.
Great. We don't mind.
you can bolster our image.
That's right, yeah.
We are incidentally the largest building in the county without an HVAC system. We hope soon that will be a county building.
Let's get her in the center.
Yeah, we can.
But you're okay. You can.
Yeah.
There's something here
that we need.
That's
right.
Yeah.
It must be digital because I have a finger. I'm not very technical.
Okay, have somebody show you how we.
Oh, get an engineer. There we go. Good. Yeah. Sounds pretty good at bringing these in under budget, so.
Don't let your finger cover the flash.
Whose is it?
Okay, you want to see how it, tell them how it works?
Got it.
Good luck.
All right.
Hey. Almost Photoshop. Hey. All right, we'll continue with public comment with Amanda Rice, followed by Dane Sensor.
Good morning, Chairperson Gibson, fellow supervisors. That the state of California and county are planning for the potential effects of climate change. And according to the June Planning Department newsletter, article by James Caruso, the county will prepare a climate action plan over the next 18 months that will deal with the strategies to be used to reach a challenging goal to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases. This Saturday, October 24th, communities will gather in thousands of places around the world, from Taj Mahal to Atascadero's Sunken Gardens and from the Great Barrier Reef to Cambria's Shamel Park, to draw attention to a very important number, 350. 350 is the most important number for our world. It's what scientists say is the safe upper limit for carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The current CO2 concentration is about 390 parts per million. Images showing the number 350 and event participants from around the world, including the picnic in Cambria, will be featured on giant video screens in Times Square in New York as part of a 350 countdown and will be accessible at 350.org as part of an online photo stream. The images will then be delivered to the United Nations on Monday as a visual petition to influence the Treaty on Climate Change that comes out of Copenhagen in December. This is a huge worldwide movement to build momentum for real political change. Our leaders have heard from major corporations and big polluters for a long time. Saturday, they'll finally hear from citizens and scientists. 6 weeks from now, governments will be convening in Copenhagen, Denmark, for the United Nations Climate Change Conference in order to create a new climate treaty. This event on the 24th is the best chance you and I have for influencing that treaty before negotiating positions solidify. This Saturday, there's going to be 7 actions in Slo County, and to keep it low impact, try to participate in the one nearest to you, or carpool, or take the bus, or ride your bike. At 1 p.m., church bells all over the county will ring 350 times. Between 3:50 and 7 p.m., the county's first ever carrot mob, which is a reverse boycott, will pack the quick stop at 2600 Broad to support that business's pledge to put 40% of their sales back into energy efficient improvements. Transition Towns is sponsoring an event with music and green products fair in the Sunken Gardens from 11 to 2. And at Shamel Park in Cambria, which is where I will be, we're going to have live music and a picnic from noon to 4. And to minimize the impact of Cambria's event, we're giving away free raffle tickets. We're going to have some great prizes. I'm going to run out of time. You can go to cambria350.org to read more about our event. And Jill Knight's going to be playing. And I just want to say that as of this morning, there were 3,902 events registered for the 24th in 163 countries on the globe. So if you can, you should participate in one of them. Thank you.
All right. An interesting movement. Thank you, Ms. Rice. And our final request to speak, Mr. Sensor.
Yes, Dane Sensor. As you know, I've come up here many a times speaking on behalf of victims' rights. And one of the nice things about this county is that it provides a law library, and for people such as myself and others that might not have the opportunity to hire a lawyer or afford a lawyer, and represent in pro per. So it's a nice benefit to those who don't have that luxury to have the financial whereabouts to hire a lawyer. However, I do want to say, you know, before I make my comment, that Barry Lewis, the law librarian, since the last 5 years I've been coming there, has been nothing more than exceptional, professional, and a very efficient law librarian. However, in the last several weeks, I have visited the law library, and I want to say that I've been approached by an employee there, Christina Robertsons, who has literally told me that I am not allowed in the law library, and I am working with a representing somebody, helping them along in a case that the State Department of Fair Housing has acknowledged that she has a case, and I have a case. But however, Christina Robertson has said to us that, and I want to give you the date, on October 10th, she asked that we go to the other library and that we don't come to this library because she doesn't want, and I quote, the crazy train stopping here, and telling me that I'm codependent and telling that the person that I'm helping is she doesn't want the crazy train here. This is totally uncalled for. It's not only discriminatory, it's harassment. I should have the opportunity. I follow the code of conduct over there. I've been coming there for 5 years. And I would like the Board of Supervisors of the county to look into this because I did file a patron's complaint with Barry, and I have heard from several other attorneys that there's been problems. So I hope some other attorneys will acknowledge what I'm saying. It's allegedly at this point in time. However, I do not want to be felt like I'm being harassed when I walk into a library, or I'm felt told to go to the public library instead of the law library. It's my constitutional right. It's my privilege to be able to go there and represent myself where I cannot afford a lawyer, and there's many material there that affords me to do that. And when I'm denied that, it's, in my opinion, discriminatory, it's harassment, and it's illegal. So I would like the county and the board to look into this matter. I have filed, I have made complaints with the Superior Court, to Susan Matherly, and the county, and with Barry, and I hope it'll be taken care of because I do not want to be felt harassed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sensor. I believe Mr. Jensen wants to respond briefly.
Mr. Sensor, Warren Jensen, County Council.
Mr. Sensor?
I'm sorry, Mr. Sensor. I'm Warren Jensen, the County Council. I also serve as President of the Law Library Board of Trustees. I have not heard of this complaint. Have you filed a written complaint?
Yes, I have, as of today.
Could you get that to me, to my office?
I will give you a copy.
Okay, yeah. And we will definitely look into that.
Yeah, I carbon copied, and Barry's supposed to give you a copy, and I did file with him.
I haven't seen it
yet.
Yeah,
and I do want to say, I've been coming there for 5 years. I've never had a problem. Barry Lewis has been an extraordinary law librarian. But recently, this not only happened once, I let it go the first time, it happened again. And the second time, I just, you know, it's very uncomfortable.
So we'll look into it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Jensen. That concludes our public comment period. So we'll close to the public, bring it back to the board for our first item of board business. Madam Clerk.
First item is D1, an update on the pandemic influenza H1N1 2009.
To update us, we have our County Health Officer, Dr. Penny Borenstein. How are you, ma'am?
Good morning. Just so you know, these respiratory symptoms have been going on for months and are presumably due to allergies, so if you were to put me off work, I would have been out for about 4 months.
This is an update, not a demonstration. Thank you. Thank you very much.
So, pandemic 2009, H1N1, influenza A. There's good news, there's bad news, and just by way of update, I'll start with the bad news. 41 states in the United States are now reporting widespread influenza activity. Virtually all of it is this particular virus. There are no other influenza A viruses or B viruses circulating at this time. And in the past week, nationally as well as locally, we've seen an increase in illness, in hospitalization rates, and deaths. Not deaths in this county, but in the other factors, we have seen it both locally, statewide, and nationally. All of this exceeds what we normally expect to find at this time of year. Typically, flu levels are very low at this time of year. In California, we've now had more than 3,000 hospitalizations documented and more than 200 deaths. And in our county, our most recent report is 11 hospitalizations and no deaths. Now, you may ask, why is that, when there was a newspaper article a while back about one related death? Is the new influenza season started August 30th, and so we reset the clock, and so we are now, like CDC, counting from that time period forward. So for the astute members who've been following the numbers, we actually have composite numbers of hospitalizations that are considerably higher, but that's where we're at right now. And again, locally, we have been seeing increased reports of influenza-like illness. We've had some really large numbers in school absenteeism, and the emergency departments are beginning to report increased usage. Of course, there are far more cases than we have numbers for, because the lab is only testing those hospitalized cases or fatalities, and we are also offering, though, testing for cluster illnesses so that we can do a better job of surveillance and knowing where we have clusters of illness that are due to this virus. All is not, hope is not lost, though. Good news is that there have been no significant changes in the virus. The importance of that is that the vaccine that's currently under in the manufacturing process is a good match for this vaccine, so we fully expect it to be effective. And also, the virus continues to be sensitive to the antiviral medications that are available, Tamiflu and Relenza, with very little resistance at this time. And also, good news is that the severity of illness appears to be staying as it was in the spring, so not getting any worse. With respect to infection control, it has taken a pretty wild ride. First, hospitals weren't doing much with respect to isolating patients when this first came available. Then the guidance became very strict. They were supposed to use negative pressure rooms, which are few and far between in our county, fully gown, glove, mask for patients with this illness. And if they themselves, if a healthcare worker, hospital worker became sick, that they were to remain off for a seven-day period, which is putting real strain on the staffing of our hospitals at a time when we're seeing more ill patients. New guidance has now come out that has put the healthcare workers in line with everybody else, and the recommendation is to stay home, stay off of work, out of school for 24 hours after fever abates without use of anti-fever medication. There's one exception to that, obviously, which is the healthcare workers that are working with immune-compromised patients, that they would continue to need to be off work for 7 days. Respiratory protection is still, however, recommended, which is to use a fit-tested respirator. And in some sectors, those have become difficult to have adequate supply. So CDC has now come out with a prioritization list of, in times of short supply, of those types of masks, that they would be utilized in a sensible fashion for those with the highest need first. But still, the best protective measures in terms of infection control, the things that we've been saying, you know, throughout public health's existence, and certainly this past year, which is frequent hand washing, coughing into tissues or sleeve, not rubbing eyes, mouth, nose, staying home when sick, and staying away from people who appear to potentially have flu-like illness. Should the severity of the illness change, we may need to revisit some of the more draconian measures, which I'm happy to not have had to even visit at this time, but you know, they remain viable options should the situation change: isolation, quarantine, cancellation of mass events, and things of that nature. With respect to vaccine, it is coming much more slowly than initially anticipated. The manufacturers gave a very optimistic rollout of millions of doses by this time. It is much more modest. We have 2,800 doses of the nasal spray in our county at present. We have ordered our October allotment of just over 40,000 doses, which are to be spread throughout the provider community in a prioritized fashion, though it now appears that most of that may not be available until November. But with respect to the prioritization, we expect to get quite a few of those doses, and we are aiming our doses at doing school-based clinics. Just yesterday, I met with all the superintendents of schools, and they again reaffirmed that every school in this county is going to participate in offering school-based influenza vaccinations during the school day. And we're also working with private schools who are interested in doing that. The other priority groups, we're getting vaccine out to all the obstetricians to vaccinate the pregnant women, to pediatricians with a primary focus initially on the very young preschool children and ultimately on all children when supplies allow, and also to other providers for adult care in order to vaccinate caretakers of infants who cannot get the vaccine themselves and those with comorbid conditions like diabetes, asthma, heart conditions, and the list goes on. We're also working closely with Cal Poly. They are going to ambitiously try to offer vaccine to any student under the age of 25, and they are gearing up for early November to do some mass clinics, and we're working with them. Ultimately, we do think we will have enough vaccine for anyone who wants a dose, but the timeline on that is a little less clear right now. We're still hoping by the end of the year, but remains to be seen. As I said, with respect to antiviral medications, they are available, they're in ample quantity, and they are still effective, but we are continuing to recommend that they be used judiciously and only for those who are at risk for poor outcomes so that we don't go down the path of developing resistance. Just yesterday, the Centers for Disease Control came out with a new recommendation, which is don't wait for lab confirmation. If you've got a hospitalized patient, you think it's ILI, influenza-like illness, this swine flu, take the lab specimen but begin treatment immediately and not wait for that lab result. Public information is the last thing I want to talk about, and that I think is really our main challenge in this. There is a host of information out there, some of it good, some of it fallacious. And so managing the public information is perhaps our greatest challenge. Even the technical information is voluminous and comes at us with great rapidity, and just keeping up with it with a limited number of technical experts has proven to be a challenge for us. Nonetheless, we are continuing to make it available in all forms that we can. We use our rapid alert system, BlastFax, to all providers. We now have a new and improved website, which we think is providing a lot more up-to-date information. We've got brochures. We're doing presentations of this sort, and we're working with and using the media to help get the message out. So, in sum, I think we are doing the best job that we can given the resources available, and we are hoping that the virus continues to behave as it has been up till this point. We do expect that there will be many more cases of illness, hospitalizations, and perhaps fatalities, but we will do our best to mitigate the effects of this illness.
Thank you, Dr. Bornstein. I didn't know if there are any, are there any questions of her? I think she did. Yeah. You know, just to be sure, you know, in dealing with these sorts of public health situations, I think it's always important that we give the public the right information, you know, not underestimate nor overestimate the threat here. So what I heard you say was that there's a disease, the H1N1, the so-called swine flu, is mildly to moderate in terms of its severity, but rather contagious, and that we're seeing many more cases of flu than otherwise would be, that again hand washing seems to be the new ritual that we should all engage in, and I guess we're going to see some changes around the county building here, the possibility of hand sanitizer being placed at the entrance, the idea of trying to break that chain of infection. Yeah, you also would like to quote a phone number or a website where the public can get more information?
Yes. Certainly our public health information line where you can passively get information is 788-2903. That's our fill line, public health information line. If you don't have your questions answered through that source, you can call our main phone number at 781-5500. and I am hunting for the website because it is not easy. Actually, if you just go on the Maine County's webpage, you will see it right at the top. It says Pandemic Influenza Information, and you can click on that, and it will take you to a host of other links.
We appreciate the health department's broad interaction with lots of agencies here. I understand the schools in particular you're very active with, as well as all first responders, the hospitals, and a wide range of individuals. So we thank you for that. We thank you for the update.
Thank you.
Public
questions?
Sure.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I very much appreciate this information and the fact that KCBX and AGP are propagating it to the public. Am I to understand that there also are sort of the standard flus still in a simmering state that may emerge later, and that there may also be a standard vaccine for which generally the older people get preference because that's sort of the traditional way that flu behaves. This particular H1N1, obviously, it's the young people who are in the greatest need based on the pattern. So I just want to clarify whether that's also something to be aware of. And then a broader question relative to the origin of both the H1N1 and various other strains of flu, they tend to be apparently associated with the existence of confined animal facilities, large numbers of animals being raised in close quarters. And although that hasn't been too much of a local issue in this county, it always could become one. Many of us remember the time when we were facing almost a million chickens south of Shandon, and actually the county approved the project on a negative declaration, despite it having the nitrate impact of a city of 40,000 people, and it was only stopped at the State Water Resources Control Board level when the conditions were too much for the applicant. But I guess the question I'm coming to is, given that the Commerce Clause, we can't simply discriminate against outside people versus county people in deciding to have an enterprise of this sort. Is Ag Policy 8 sufficient protection against the type of facility from which a new strain of influenza can emerge? The H1N1 has at least been tentatively traced to a confined animal facility in Mexico. And, of course, that the town next to that confined animal facility was the place where the epidemic was first described and to which it has been at least tentatively traced. And so if there is such an association, if there is a genuine health and safety issue, right now AGP-8 more or less just describes there are various types of intensive facilities, locate them appropriately, et cetera, et cetera. It does not actually set firm ceilings based on health and safety issues. And so, normally we talk general plan with planning people and agriculture people, but with health people in the room, I guess I want to have that question out there in a health context. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. He did have a request to speak here. I'll open it to the public for any other comments or questions. Seeing no one coming forward, we'll close it to the public. Dr. Bornstein, you want to
Certainly the first item Mr. Greening mentioned is very important, and I thank you for getting that out, that seasonal influenza vaccination is still a recommendation. Vaccine is available. We have provided a lot of it, and other providers still have it. It is most recommended for individuals above the age of 65, but also all children. So children who have never been vaccinated stand to get a lot of influenza vaccine this year. Thank you for that. With respect to the animal route of transmission of the genesis of new flu strains, animals of various types, particularly swine and poultry, do play a role in mixing genes amongst themselves and with human beings in creating new strains. As to the science of the confinement in and of itself being a risk, I can't address that per se. What I do know is that it is the manner in which humans interact with the animals that creates opportunities for the sharing of flu strains, that is the mechanism by which genetic recombination can occur. But as to the science of the setting alone presenting a risk factor versus the way in which the humans interact with the animals in that setting, I don't have the technical expertise to address.
Right. Very interesting business, virology, but perhaps a topic for another day. With that, again, thank Dr. Bornstein and the Public Health Department for a lot of hard work going on, mostly behind the scenes at this point. With that, Madam Clerk, would you introduce our next item, please?
The next item is briefing by the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation on the planned reuse of the former Paso Robles Correctional Facility.
Chief Deputy Reed, how are you, sir?
Good morning, Board Chairman Gibson. My name is Rob Reed. I'm Chief Deputy with the San Luis Obispo Sheriff's Department. In March of 2008, the county and the Sheriff's Department applied for AB 900 funding for a new women's facility at the county jail. We were successful in that in being awarded approximately $25 million. One of the agreements that we entered into at that time was with CDCR in helping them site a reentry facility within the county. As part of that agreement, here today is Mr. Bob Sleppy from CDCR and Laura, and I'm sorry, Laura, I can't remember your last name, but
Enderton,
to present to you where they are in the progress of what they're doing with the former boys' school at Paso Robles. Bob?
Hopefully up on your screen will be some slides. There we go. I'm Bob Sleppy with the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. I'm the Environmental Services Chief. We just wanted to take a very few seconds every day, and number one, I want to thank the public health person. I just got my shot last Friday. Corrections is really big on getting ready for the flu season. We're doing something pretty interesting up in Paso Robles. We have owned a former youth authority facility up in Paso Robles by the airport for many, many, many years, almost five decades. It's about 160 acres of land. In July of 2008, because of the significant descent in our population of juvenile wards in California due to sending them back to the counties, we went from about 10,000 wards a few years back to we're under 1,500 right now statewide. So we've seen a lot of our juvenile justice facilities go into kind of a surplus mode. They're down to a handful of wards. The decision was made to formally close the Paso Robles facility in July 2008. There just weren't enough wards to sustain the operation. Because of this trend in California, we're not going to see that type of facility that, as far as we project, to come back to life again. It's going to be an empty surplus state facility. Meantime, we have on the adult side of the Department of Corrections over 150,000 inmates currently housed in our 33 prisons in California, plus some out-of-state inmates. That brings us at an operational capacity of about 180% of what we'd like to be at, about 140%. Of capacity, but we're about 180 right now. You probably are vaguely aware that we're operating under a number of court orders, including we're about to get the court order on overcrowding. We have overcrowding orders. We have mental health. We have medical care, things like that. So we are launching a project up in Paso Robles beginning tomorrow. The EIR process is going to start formally on three things on this property. We're going to propose to reuse the old youth authority for a kind of a minimum, a medium security prison, a level 2. That's our second lowest level of inmate classification. We're targeting that for 1,000 total inmates, which is about 520 staff. We've targeted that because that facility works really well for older inmates at this lower classification. They're dormitories. We don't have to do much to the housing units to be able to reuse them. The only thing we have to do at that facility is kind of upgrade some of the utilities. We We're going to put a much bigger security system around the perimeter of it. So first piece is we're going to look at the process, go through the process of planning for an adult prison there. The second thing is, as Rob indicated, we have a new idea in prisons in California, and that's that in this county, last year you had 750 parolees come back to your county. When you complete your term or you're paroled, you come back to the county of last residence. These inmates are coming out of horribly overcrowded conditions, whether you like inmates or not, feel sorry for them or compassionate for them. They come out of very difficult situations, no program space, no recreation areas, no chance to kind of have a little one-on-one with a counselor. So we're proposing to build, under a new state law passed in 2007, we call them secure reentry facilities. The maximum size is a 500-bed facility. It's not going to look like a prison, although it's certainly going to operate like one in terms of the security system. It's going to be a lot more like a jail in terms of physical facility. Won't have a fence around it. I have some pictures of it. But that facility will provide an opportunity to get these inmates in their last 12 months before they parole to get some program opportunities, to get some education, to get some job training. It's not a work release place. It's still just confinement for 1 year as they finish their terms. But we're going to proposing to put one of those up in the corner of the property. That is an agreement among three counties, which together have enough parolees coming out to support a 500-bed facility. It is also loosely tied, or it is indirectly tied, to the grant program for county jails, yours being a $23 million proposal, Santa Barbara and San Benito are the other two counties. The third little leg of this project is that Cal Fire used to have a conservation camp function when we had the juvenile wards there, because they could bring them out, take them to a fire, take them to a conservation project. They have a few buildings up there, and they have the physical crews to haul them off and take them and bring them back. Well, once the DJJ closed down, we didn't have that anymore. So we're proposing to provide Cal Fire with a room to build a full standalone conservation camp. This is a high priority for the San Luis Obispo Ranger headquarters here in San Luis Obispo County, because they have such limited conservation crews for fires, in particular in the Central Coast region. So basically, we're going to hopefully provide them room and free property, because the state owned already. The property is just out by the airport off of Highway 46 East. It's just the airport. It's off to the east of that picture. We have owned this perfect 160-acre quarter section for quite a while now. It is currently has the DJJ facility in the east corner. The Cal Fire operation buildings are up to the top of it. We're proposing to remodel the old DJJ. We're talking about providing the room at the top of the picture for the Cal Fire for a new full conservation camp, and we're talking about putting this proposed reentry off in the kind of back in the corner. These are all independent operations, although there'll be some synergy. The total between these three, we'll spend about $100 million proposed to reopen the former juvenile justice facility, where the reentry is about $150 million in construction. You pick up about 700 to 850 jobs between the facilities once they're operational. They are not dependent on each other, but there will be operational efficiencies to having the two side by side. Sorry, I'm going to hit the next slide. We have grand visions of how pretty the reentry could be. These are really more in a suburban setting, but we don't want the reentry to look like a prison. So we just completed having a new floor plan, and we know what a reentry is going to look like, but these are a couple examples of what they should look like. The big event is tomorrow. We want to make sure this community, Paso Robles in particular, but also the whole county, anybody else, gets information about what we're proposing to do. You know, prisons are always a challenging thing in any circumstance. We've had good working relationship with the city of Paso Robles, thanks to your supervisor here and others. But we want to make sure everybody knows about our project, gets a chance to comment, you know, plus or minus about it, get information about it. So we're holding a pair of public workshops tomorrow to launch our EIR process. They'll be identical. Be one at 1:30 and one in the evening. We'll have a workshop where people can meet with our staff one-on-one, talk about custody, talk about reentry, talk about parolees, talk about EIR stuff. And then we're going to have a formal presentation on the project as well as taking comments. So we hope to get launched where people can get some information about this, get their concerns out if they have them. We'll then, of course, go through the EIR process here in the coming months. We appreciate the support we've had and the interest in the project. We particularly appreciate the support from the Sheriff's Office. We have a one-of-a-kind agreement in Paso Robles. It's a memorandum of understanding between the three counties involved in the reentry and the city and our department on how we will operate that facility. We've never had anything like that anywhere else. It talks about how we're going to not let the inmates walk down the street and how we're going to release them and how we're going to transport them, and the city's not going to inherit some liability otherwise they wouldn't have. So we're very proud of that MOU. It was very closely negotiated with the police chief and others in the city and the counties. We particularly appreciate your county, both on the fire side, Cal Fire, and the Sheriff's Department, very helpful to us. We appreciate your new supervisor. He's been very very good in opening opportunities for us to talk about this project to the community. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Questions? So, Mr. Patterson?
Yes, thank you. Two questions. The aerial that you showed with the reentry facility and then the conservation camp, I think they were up to the back. Where is Airport Road relative to that?
Just going along the right-hand side of that picture.
Okay.
So. Yeah, we didn't get a big enough aerial. This is Airport Road's coming down. The 446 is down here. Airport Road's here. Airport runway's over here. We're going to be looking very closely at Airport Road. It's getting affected.
You, and maybe I missed it in your presentation, but do you have a estimated timeline as to when these facilities will come online?
Probably the two ones we control. Cal Fire is trying to get their budget. It's actually a high priority for Cal Fire, but and it should go a little faster because the land is owned for a change. It's always slows Cal Fire down. Ours are probably about 3 years out. Reentry facility proposing to use a design build process, which would be a little faster, maybe right at 24 months. The redo of Australia is, probably more like 30 months. But they're in the queue. We have funding for them. We have major support for those. So we're hopeful. EIR will take us about 9 months to get through that process.
Thank you.
Mr. Hill.
Thank you very much.
Here we got at least one more question here from my colleague.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a new model that we're going to with the reentry facility.
Yeah, we're quite proud. We had a little gap here. Nothing happened for a while because we had no, as you all know, state budget. And we went from kind of a really idealized building to now we're going to show tomorrow the interior of the actual prototypical. We're big on prototypical. We build once one way and we keep on building that way because we know it works. So we have worked for several months now with architect programmers, and our custody staff in particular, our security staff, on a set building that we believe can house 500 people, can have the program space, can have the security, especially custody and security, transport vehicles coming in behind gates. So, we believe, an effective model now for this facility. We can show people how it works. And also it offers the opportunity for an attractive outside appearance.
Let me get to the less literal sense of model. The idea here, I guess, that Corrections is pursuing is to reduce recidivism significantly?
We are as anxious as anyone that these inmates go out and they come back. They go out and they come back. They go out because they're just so unprepared. Like it or not, they're just so unprepared. We had a hearing up in Salinas a while back, and we had a lot of parolees come to it, and it was startling. People that have been out 10 years that finally made it, people that have been out a year, that they're just overwhelmed with, regardless of how you feel about people who have committed crimes, they come out so unprepared. And they're coming out of double, triple bunk gymnasiums where there's no chance for educational opportunities, no chance to get at maybe some of your personal problems. So hopefully, these facilities will be a little more room in them, counselors, education opportunities, job training opportunities, so they come out hopefully a little better prepared than they're coming out right now.
So this is all a stage of transition from...
Yeah, we're trying to build, five or six of these statewide to kind of get them going. We have three other sites in this that currently we're working on.
Thank you.
Mr. Beecher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Mr. Schleppi. I know that it's taken some time to finally get to some fruitful discussion on all of this, and I appreciate the openness of the state to engage with the city of Paso Robles in particular about what's going to happen there, how it's going to happen there, and the impacts that may be created. I'll be at your session tomorrow. I'm anxious to hear what you are going to be proposing. But one thing I wondered if you'd clarify for us, please, is we mentioned the level of inmate, level 2, level 1, level 3. That determination, if I understand this correctly, is not based upon the crime they committed, but how they acted in jail. Is that correct?
When you get yourself committed to state prison, first off, you had to work at that. You know, for the most part, most people have had a little history of crime and commitment to jails. But when you come in the system, we treat you as dangerous. We put you at our highest level, and unless there's some compelling reason. So we put you at a level 4 classification. We want to know who you are, how you're going to behave. Your behavior is going to allow you to descend into the lower classification where you have a little more freedom. You're not housed in a cell 24 hours a day. So we take this very seriously. It's hard to descend. You have to kind of not gain points. You have to lose points. So the minute you act out, the minute you assault an officer, the minute you do something bad, then you're going back up in the system. So when we get to a level 2, it's almost like a graduate school. You must be being a pretty compliant inmate, getting along. We're also targeting older inmates because that facility is so flat and it would work well for people that aren't getting around well. And we have a lot of these lifer long sentence types. So yeah, we take the system quite seriously. Everybody starts with a big burden to prove they're really an okay, easy to deal with.
And then the other only question is the MOU that was established. I know there was a lot of work put into that, but the relationship between the three counties that will be participatory in this, are they all three of like mind in terms of the release and how these folks are going to be handled once the release takes place?
We haven't all talked for a while because everything's been on hold, but I would say that we do. We had good agreement when we worked on that MOU, and the city had some reluctance, but I feel like the three counties really stepped up and are really committed to, transport away from the county, things like that, so Pastor Robles doesn't see all the parolees sitting down at the bus station, things like that.
One of the concerns for my colleagues that was expressed up there was the fact that when a person is released, they're supposed to go back into the jurisdiction in which they were arrested. How they get there was a concern, yeah. And so that was part of the MOU.
I got in a lot of trouble with my boss, who runs prisons. We had never committed to making sure the inmate got the heck out of the county back to where they were going. We took them down the bus station, we made sure they got on the bus. So this was a very good thing for the reentry program in that we are going to find a way to have them come up, pick them up, haul them down.
Thank you.
It's actually also, it's back to the county of last legal residence, not necessarily where they were arrested.
Yeah.
But everybody should have a release plan, and either their parole agent or where they're being housed or family member will be taking them out of the city of Paso Robles, unless their plan says that they're going to live in that area. So that not everybody from those counties are going to be back here.
And I would assume, too, that you're going to, with your information that you're going to provide tomorrow, not just the positive as far as jobs or these sorts of things in the reentry program, but the impacts that could be also established or created by this and how they're going to be addressed.
We're well aware that we're going to have more traffic on Airport Road. We're going to have more utility, demand. We're going to have new objects out there to look at. So we're particularly interested in the traffic situation. We tried to budget forward for potential mitigation. It's hard to fix Airport Road, frankly, and especially down at 46. But we're very well aware of that and trying to get all these things out on the table. I think we've been particularly responsive to the city's concerns. They got to see administrative versions of our notices, so they had a chance to have some input to them. We tried to support CAL FIRE on getting some inmates as soon as we can to get their camp going again. That'll be proof in the pudding. We got to get the inmates there first. Type inmates that come out to do camp work are only level 1, so you're minimum security. They've proven they're responsible citizens. Thank you very much. I appreciate a chance
to
come before
you. All right. Thank you, Mr. Lippe. Appreciate that. That will move on to our last public item of the morning. Madam Clerk, if you would introduce that for us, please.
We have a consideration of 1, a resolution adopting the expenditure plan for Proposition 1B, transportation revenue for the 2009-2010 fiscal year, and 2, a budget adjustment in the amount of $5,246,228 to the Road Fund Center 245, all districts. Recommended approval and instruct chairperson to sign.
Mr. Flynn.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Honorable Board. Dave Flynn with Public Works Department. Today's item is to look at Proposition 1B Transportation Revenue Expenditure Plan. Proposition 1B was an initiative passed in 2006 by voters. It provided $19.6 billion statewide for transportation. The county can avail itself of funding through certain categories. The primary category is local streets and roads program under the proposition, which allots approximately $11.3 million to the county. The state has, or the county has also sought funding from Prop 1B through the state local partnership program for Willow Road and has received $2 million for that. And there's lesser programs in there that we've received for transit improvements as well as some seismic retrofit work. Today's element, though, focuses on the local street and road program. And this requires an expenditure plan be submitted to the State Department of Finance in order to receive the funds. Only after the county has submitted this plan can bonds be sold and then revenues provided to the county. The next bond sale is pending next month, hence we're trying to get the plan approved and submitted by the end of this month so that we can receive the revenues for this fiscal year. We have already submitted plans previously for the 07-08 and 08-09 fiscal year cycle. This expenditure plan would cover the remaining $5.3 million of the program. For the use of Proposition 1B funds, it's all stated in the government codes how they're processed. What they're looking for are projects that have at least a 15-year life cycle so that they can adequately bond for the improvements. As a department, what we've done is we've sought use of this funding to serve as our local match for other federal grants to advance shortfalls in priority projects and then to put towards preventative maintenance work. There is some ability to provide general maintenance activities through these sources of funds. However, it is limited up to the discretion of the Department of Finance in that there is adequate life cycle in the work being conducted. An example of that would be chip seals that our crews have been doing over the last year. That would probably be acceptable to Department of Finance. Other things of just routine maintenance would not. This was the expenditure plan approved in early 2008. These are all projects that have been completed or are under construction. We've tried to make ready use of the funds. In June of this year, you approved the $1.7 million for the 08-09 expenditure based off of these two projects, one being a North County road safety improvement and the other being San Simeon Creek Road bridges. That amount of $811,000 would serve as the local match for moving ahead with construction next year. In selecting projects, what we've looked at is this is one-time funding. We'll get the $11.3 million, and then there's no additional funding after that. Over the years, we've identified rural road safety as a general need, particularly for our county and the North County in particular, and many of the projects have been identified through that process, as well as federal grants, particularly the bridge program. We've used this for Moonstone Beach Drive bridge replacement we conducted last year, and then San Simeon and Main Street Bridge. In subsequent years, we would use this funding to serve as our local match. We also had a project before your board in early September regarding the erosion repair project on Avila Beach Drive. We felt that was an urgent matter that had to be dealt with, and so we're now under construction to begin work and stabilize that road prior to heavy winter storms. What we did, though, was we took preventative maintenance funding that we had to cover the construction of that project in the near term, and our intentions would be to have $1 million of the remaining Prop 1B funds be put back into preventative maintenance to replace that money. Those were actions that were before your board again in your first meeting in September. We did have in previous expenditure plans listed two additional projects. One was Orchid Road at Rigetti Road, and another was River Road near the St. Lawrence Terrace area. Those projects we no longer see
funding through Prop 1B as there's insufficient funding remaining in the program. Another factor to be aware of is the continued or looming issue of highway user tax account. And again, this last budget cycle in the extraordinary sessions of the legislature, this was a key topic about whether these would be withheld or diverted. While we were relieved from that process this last summer, it is understood that this could come up again, particularly after the first of the year. With that, the county does receive approximately a little over $5 million in this funding source every year, which does fund our routine maintenance activities. As an element of the Prop 1B funds, we could set aside portions of the money if the HUDA or the highway user tax account funding is withheld, and then look at backfilling it. Part of the resolution before you would provide the Director of Public Works the ability to exchange out our proposed overlay project to potentially use to cover any shortfalls in this matter. At this point in time, we don't have any action from the legislature to withhold the user tax account funding, but we would like to be prepared in that event to earmark perhaps $1 million through this process to backfill any maintenance things, as long as it's qualified under the Department of Finance. With that, what our recommended expenditure plan before you today includes these projects, and at the very end is the Willow Road overlay. Again, that's really backfilling our preventative maintenance account from the Avila Beach Drive erosion repair project, but would also be the potential project that we would work with the Department of Finance to exchange out for that sum of money to provide general maintenance accounting if it is acceptable to the Department of Finance. So with that, our recommendation is to adopt the resolution with that expenditure plan. Authorize the Director of Public Works to exchange Willow Road project for general maintenance activity expense if the user tax account funding is withheld and if it's allowable by the Department of Finance. And then approve a budget adjustment to add this funding into the current fiscal year. That concludes my report. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Question, Mr. Shadjan.
Thank you, Mr. Flannon. So if the HUDA funding withheld and allowable by the Department of Finance is not the case, so what happens to funding for Willow?
We would move ahead then with the Willow Road as an overlay project. Okay. And again, this
so
is
either
the,
case, you're not risking what's already there for Willow.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
For the Willow Road overlay project. And as I understand it, there will be HUDA deferrals still. We're going to be waiting a little extra time. Does that play into your anything that you presented here today?
It may. That certainly has been the course of action over the last two fiscal years, generally deferring to the third or fourth quarter on the payments. But in general, unless there's a complete termination of the funding, you know, we'll go with the expenditure plan as listed. If there is the actual withdrawal, then we would go to Department of Finance and just take the subsequent action of getting it to general maintenance.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Flynn, you mentioned that this is one-time money, the Prop 1B, and we also got some federal stimulus money for road projects as well, and knowing that the future will require further reductions in spending in roads as well as everything else that we have before us here at the county, are you considering the fact that this money is one-time money, should be used for projects that we might otherwise use general fund money, where it's allowable to exchange that money and then meter it out as long as we can to keep our our current staff employed until the economy turns around. Are you trying to utilize this money in a way that it will benefit both our current workforce here and also our general fund contribution?
I guess the short answer would be yes. It is a balancing act in the sense that the money does have to be spent within a three-year period. Certainly, what we've seen is any general fund contribution that the Roads Fund has seen, as well as other type of funding, such as Prop 42, which is very discretionary, that is going towards our preventative maintenance or routine maintenance to keep the roads functioning. Only this one-time funding is really looked at towards capital side and keeping what amounts to be our engineers working on a stream of projects. But this is less discretionary money than some of these other sources. And again, those Prop 42 is really committed to the ongoing operations of the road activities.
I just think that it's important that we recognize our fiscal condition and utilize this money, again, since it's one time, to our best advantage to and take some of the other more discretionary money and perhaps withhold that and use it later if we can.
Yeah, understood.
Mr. Meacham?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just quickly wanted to make a comment that I greatly appreciate, and I don't envy your position trying to maintain all these miles and miles of roads throughout this county, but you guys do a pretty doggone good job of trying to keep up with all of this. So trying to squeeze the water balloon, if you will, to try to get to where we have to be next, it's going to be more difficult as we go. Obviously, we see the difficulty from a financial standpoint, but from my standpoint, I greatly appreciate your guys' your effort and what you do. You do a good job with what we have.
I do as well. And one other question that I had with the current expenditure plan, does that fully fund the La Ponza Road correction, La Ponza Road project?
Yes, backing up on the expenditure plan, La Ponza Road would essentially total about $1.5 million, which we feel is an adequate project. To safeguard that, though, we are also applying for some additional federal safety grants and seeing if we're successful. If that's the case and there is money freed up, that gives us some flexibility to look at perhaps putting that back or coming back to you and revising this expenditure plan.
Right.
I would say thank you for your regard to the road staff. I think what you find out in the field is you have a highly experienced staff out there who's really doing super work, particularly after like the latest storm.
If I may, Mr. Chair, I concur with my colleagues here that the roads department, they are experienced and they do a great job with what they have. Following up with Supervisor Gibson's comment regarding La Ponza Road, I know that's a very high priority for safety reasons, and you've budgeted two cycles of this Prop 1B money for that. With that funding, is that enough to complete that project in its entirety?
Yes, I certainly believe that's sufficient, particularly, it's just really a safeguard to assure that we have some federal safety grant. We feel it's a pretty good candidate, and so that's where we may be able to recoup some funds out of this process.
Thank you.
Very good. Seeing no other lights on, I'll open it to the public. We don't have requests to speak, nor anyone coming forward, so we'll close it to the public, bring it back forward for action.
Chairman, I'd make a motion that we adopt the attached resolution and approve the attached budget adjustment.
I'll second.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham and Mr. Patterson. And we do need a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Asajian?
Aye.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. That brings us to public comment. Similarly, no requests to speak, no members of the public coming forward. We'll close it to the public. Ask Mr. Jensen for an estimate.
60 to 90 minutes.
And we will report out at 1:30, and let's plan to convene closed session at 10:45. That's thank you. Welcome back to our afternoon session. We'll start, as always, with a report out of closed session.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Warren Jensen, County Council. The board did meet in closed session. No reportable action was taken.
All right, thank you. So we come to our afternoon public comment session. Items not on the agenda. I do have four requests to speak. And just to confirm, Ms. Taylor, you're going to speak on the Water Resources Advisory Council in general, or is it about Los Osos? Okay, thank you. Very good. Why don't you start for us, please? And then I have three speakers on the subject of Los Osos, apparently. So Ms. Taylor, followed by Chris Allaby.
Good afternoon. My name is Gwen Taylor. I'm a resident of Los Osos. For years, I've been concerned about water. I've stood up before this board, a board, and many other boards professing that we need to conserve our water and also that we have saltwater intrusion. On September the 2nd, the Water Resources Advisory Committee held the first presentation of the proposed Master Water Plan by Carrillo Engineering. The plan encompasses all the county's water basins. At this presentation, the public informed the presenter that there is salt water intrusion in the Los Osos water basin due to the overpumping of the groundwater. Additionally, the public noticed the presenters that there was an interlocutory stipulated judgment in which the four purveyors are a part. This was not addressed at the time of the Carrillo presentation. The same engineering firm that designed the Los Osos wastewater sewer project. On October 1st, at a master water plan workshop, the RAC had another presentation by Carrillo Engineering on the proposed master water plan for the county. In a PowerPoint presentation, Morro Bay and Los Osos were combined as one water basin. That supplemented water was supplied by State Water to Los Osos, and a desalinization plant also was part of the supplemental water. To the chairperson's credit, Mr. Wynn, he encouraged discourse on the PowerPoint presentation, and once again, the public informed the engineers that Morro Bay and Los Osos are two separate water basins, and Los Osos does not have any resource of supplemental water, period. This, in the same engineering, is the same engineering firm that the board hired for the design of a wastewater project for Los Osos. Is it any wonder that the number of appeals were submitted on this project to this board? Thank you. I hope you listened.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Mr. Allaby, followed by Al Barrow.
My spiel is going to consist of some comments on the saltwater intrusion. The rate of saltwater intrusion in our community is... We don't even know if it can be stopped, let alone what the rate of intrusion is. Some examples of expert testimony, July 15th of 09, Coastal Commission of Pablo Ogren in a letter. We received compelling public testimony that seawater intrusion constitutes an imminent crisis that warrants immediate attention. We are concerned that continued SWI in the water basin threatens to render a lower aquifer unusable. On March 30th, 07, TAC report comments by Dr. Tom Ruhr, international soil water expert. We must be much more serious about seawater intrusion. The TAC ignored the issue. State water should be avoided due to the mercury content and the poisonous organic compounds contained therein. During direct questioning at open meetings, has resulted in no answer to the general public, or we won't know until the project is built, which of course is ridiculous. The probable scenario here is me paying off two sewer bonds, one at huge costs and one we're paying off now on our property taxes, a desal plant bond when they find that nothing else will stop the seawater intrusion, plus our property tax, plus a mortgage payment. All this for a plant that can wait until Uncle Sam can kick in on his unfunded mandate. In summation, this project violates many provisions and intents of the Coastal Act, which provides for preservation of scenic areas and adequate usable water supply. The issuing of recent building permits after a moratorium was in place caused the present overdraft we have now. Solution for that is a basin-wide moratorium until the SWI problem is hashed out. The ionization process has pretty much eliminated the small nitrate problem we did have, and now the SWI situation could kill the whole wastewater project and saddle up as an enormous debt for no useful purpose whatever. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Alibi. Mr. Barrow, followed by Ben DeFada.
Good afternoon. My name is Al Barrow, Coalition for Low-Income Housing. I want to talk a little bit about affordable housing. The first thing is I want to say that 5% of the residents of this county can afford to buy a home here. That's not very many. So we do have a large homeless population, and we do have a need for affordable housing, of demand for it, strong demand for it. And we're losing a lot of our affordable housing by flipping, you know, affordable units like, say, a little cabin that's on a nice lot that has, 700 square feet, 500 square feet, turns over into a 2,000 square foot, 3,000 square foot home. And that's been going on. So we lost a lot of those. We've lost a lot of our apartments. Apartments resold, the new owner raises the rent, $200 or $300 for a two-bedroom apartment. So we're seeing less availability of housing. So it's important that you address the transitional housing issue in the 10-year plan to end chronic homelessness. And you need to get a property out there where somebody can start building that, because this is the time we really need it right now. We don't need it 10 years ago or 10 years down the road. So that's really important. In regards to Los Osos, we only represent about 3.5% of the population of the county. Yet we're paying for the biggest sewer project, the biggest public works project that the county has had so far, $170 million. We had an assessment, and in that assessment it said, in the current project selection strategy, step and gravity alternatives would compete through the construction bidding phase using a competitive bid design build and or build, own, operate, transfer process. So that was a $25,000 assessment that we assessed ourselves based upon the language of the assessor's report. And it's a concern of mine that you have taken SEPSTEG off the table. I hope the Coastal Commission will encourage you to put it back on the table, because it is less than 50% the cost. We have estimates around $50 to $60 million. Your project is $120 million more than that. That's a serious thing. I have an engineer reporting to me, and he will report to the Coastal Commission. He manages over 100 wastewater systems. And he says your infiltration, exfiltration rate in the basin is going to pollute our drinking water basin, which is going to be the upper aquifer. That's really serious. Over 20 million gallons per year, probably more like 40 million gallons per year, of raw sewage will be going into our drinking water aquifer. It's going to be very expensive to clean up. That hasn't been addressed at all. And I hope that you will look at that, and I hope the Coastal Commission will look at it. I have a 60-page PowerPoint presentation from him that will prove that that's true. And I just hope you'll get SEPSTEG back on the table somehow. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Barrow. Mr. DeFado, followed by Anlon Perlman.
Afternoon, supervisors. You look well rested after 3-hour lunch. And DeFado here from Los Osos. You voted? No.
Next time I'm going to invite you to join us.
The gravity violac treatment project, estimated by county staff to be $165 million with foul tourist rate treatment, when you could have bought a vacuum collection and EcoFlow treatment plants were way under $100 million with tertiary treatment included, a difference of at least $70 million. 30 years of use of off-the-shelf proven technology sold all over the world, sustainable and green. In my lifetime, I have seen changes like wooden aircraft to aluminum, then to composite material being used to fly high and fast. We have gone to the moon, back and back, all with new technology. We have seen the improvements done with wooden bone-burning stoves to coal then to gas, and trains from wood to coal to diesel electric. And look at the communications industry. You get the idea. But with this sewer, nothing has been done since Nero and Caesar used them. 2,000 years later, Thomas Crapper invented the flush toilet. Here we have the opportunity to get a big jump in sewer technology, but again, you still want to build an antiquated sewer project. I want the public throughout this county to know what a waste of people's money you're spending on our wastewater project, and that it could be very well happen to them too. You're supposed to spend the people's money wisely, not foolishly. Don't you know it's beyond the people's capacity to pay for your choice of gravity biolac system? From Congresswoman Bowen Capps to Assemblyman Blakesley to you five, you're supposed to protect the public from the tax gouging you're imposing on the people. That's part of your job, too. I don't see you doing any of that. You're not helping the environment either with your gravity biolac, three trucks of sludge to haul to the dump every week. We have a sand condition out there where any leak by gravity pipes, which are more prone to break than smaller pipes, in the sand, which would end up in the ocean, in the bay. Vacuum is the only thing. If there's a leak by, for some reason, after earthquake, it would just suck it in. It wouldn't suck in sand. The EcoFluid treatment plant with tertiary treatment under $10 million. Again, nothing personal, guys. I like you all, and adios. I don't think I'll be seeing you again.
Thank you, Mr. DeFatta. Mr. Perlman.
Before you start my time, would I be allowed a minute to speak about sewer and Freeman's in general public comment?
Just a three-minute public comment, Mr. Perlman.
This has nothing to do with the Los Osos sewer, then.
Thank you.
On Thursday at the South Bay Community Center, Los Osos Community Advisory Council, of which I am a member, will be looking at proposed changes to Route 12A. I know of one person who is blind, who is picked up at the Baywood Pier stop. That stop currently is not noticed. The people who are utilizing the route, including other people with disabilities, are not aware that that stop is going to be moved, nor was the driver aware of it today. I'm making arrangements that the CSD box should contain a route map. I have one here, but I will not present it because you'll take my only copy appropriately. I repeat, Thursday, 7 o'clock, South Bay Community Center, discussing the removal of those stops. That particular base spot stop, I think, is very important also for local tourism. And as I described earlier, a few feet further down towards the bay is a significant amount of bay erosion. This has been brought up to Jeremy Gent of Public Works. He has been very helpful, but he correctly pointed out, I believe, that on issues of erosion, we are now at the point where it's very hard to fix things that are broken. One tree fell into the bay very recently. About a year ago, approximately this time, CSD Director Maria Kelly attempted to get a grant to have that erosion fixed. That was before the tree came down. That did not come through. I would like to continue to work through LOCAC, and by the way, I'm a LOCAC member, but not speaking for LOCAC. I'm speaking simply as a member of public who happens to be a LOCAC member. Additionally, a boat has flipped over, and at high tide today became lodged right next to the erosion pot itself. If anybody is watching from Los Osos, you have a boat with a black bottom that is flipped in that area. Please, and other people watching, please do not attempt to retrieve that boat through the damaged area that is marked. That will take away about 2 years' worth of work. It is very hard to fix something that is a bay because that is always a nexus of multiple agencies, and it's a difficult thing to do. I hope the board can support continued efforts by myself and other people, including LOCAC, Maria Kelly, the CSD, possibly the MBNEP will be working to try and resolve that. This is a very important gateway into Baywood, shall we say, and further losses will come to the county in much repair bills. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Perlman. That concludes our public comment period, so we'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board. Madam Clerk, if you would, introduce our next item in general.
Next item is C1, hearings to consider 7 proposals to establish new agricultural preserves and to amend an existing agricultural preserve.
Thank you. And Mr. Nall?
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I'm John Nall. I'm with the Department of Planning and Building. I'm also the alternate chair on the Ag Preserve Review Committee. Today is the first of 2 meetings where your board will consider requests to establish new agricultural preserves or amend existing Williamson Act contracts within preserves. Terry Waller is our project manager, and he'll be making the presentation on each of these items. And at this point, Mr. Chairman, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Mr. Waller.
Okay.
Terry?
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. Terry Waller, planning staff. If you'd like, I'll go ahead and introduce the item one by one. We need to open each.
Yep, and we're going to take individual action on each item, so we'll just go one by one. Okay. Sounds good.
The first proposal is by the Crandall Family Partnership, and it is to establish an agricultural preserve to enable the applicant to enter into a land conservation contract. The project site consists of approximately 160 acres within the agriculture land use category and is located just south of Hog Canyon Road, north of and abutting Independence Track 6, and approximately 7 miles due east of the community of San Miguel. The site is in the El Pomar planning area. This property has been used historically as grazing land for cattle. The property qualifies for a 100-acre minimum preserve with approximately 160 acres that includes Class 4 and 6 soils described in the Natural Resource Conservation Service Soil Survey as well-suited as rangeland. The appropriate minimum parcel size for the agricultural preserve is 320 acres based on the rangeland capability. The appropriate term is 20 years. The Agricultural Preserve Review Committee and the Planning Commission recommend approval of this request to establish an agricultural preserve. That concludes our presentation for this item.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Waller? Seeing none, I'll open it to the public. No requests to speak and no one coming forward. We'll close it to the public, bring it back to board for action.
Move that we recommend approval, approval of this request to establish agricultural preserve.
Second. A motion and a second. And a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Sajjan?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Item B.
The next item is a proposal by Bradford Jones to establish an agricultural preserve to enable the applicant to enter into a land conservation contract. The project site consists of 286 acres within the agriculture land use category and is located adjacent to and southwest of the terminus of Highway 46 at Highway 1 and approximately 1.4 miles south of the urban reserve line of the community of Cambria. The site is in the North Coast planning area. This property has also been used historically for grazing land. The property qualifies for a 100-acre minimum preserve with approximately 281 acres of land with Class 3, 4, 6, and 7 soils, described in the Natural Resource Conservation Service's Soil Survey as moderately to well-suited as rangeland. The appropriate minimum parcel size for the agricultural preserve is 320 acres based on the rangeland capability, and the appropriate term is 20 years. the Agriculture Preserve Review Committee and the Planning Commission recommend approval of this request to establish an agricultural preserve. That concludes my comments.
Thank you. Seeing no lights, I'll open it to the public. Seeing no one coming forward, I'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board, and I will move approval of staff's recommendation on B. Mr. Ashajian? And another roll call, please.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Ashajian?
Aye.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
And Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Item C.
Item C is a proposal by Bob Williams to establish an agricultural preserve to enable the applicant to enter into a land conservation contract. The project site consists of approximately 133 acres within the agriculture land use category and is located on the southeastern corner of Highway 101 and Highway 166 and approximately 2,000 feet north of the city of Santa Maria. The site is in the South County planning area. The site has been used historically for dry farming and intermittently for irrigated row crops, but limited water supply prevents more extensive and continuous cultivation of irrigated row crops on this property. The property qualifies for a 100-acre minimum preserve with approximately 118 acres of land with class 3 and 4 soils appropriate for dry farm crops. The Agricultural Preserve Review Committee, as well as the Planning Commission, recommend approval with a minimum parcel size of 160 acres and a term of 20 years.
Thank you. With no lights on, we'll open it to the public. Seeing no response, close it to the public, bring it back to the board for action.
Mr. Chair, move approval of the staff's recommendation.
I'll second.
Thank you. Mr. Ashajian and Mr. Meacham. And another roll call.
Mr. Ashajian?
Aye.
Mr. Meacham?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Item D.
The next item is a proposal by the Law Family Vineyards to alter and expand the boundaries of an existing agricultural preserve to enable the applicant to add approximately 70 acres. The total property ownership consists of 230 acres within the agriculture land use category and is located at 3830 Peachy Canyon Road, approximately 1/4 mile north of Peachy Canyon Road and approximately 3 miles west of the city of Paso Robles. The city, the site is in the Adelaide planning area. The existing preserve and contract qualified as rangeland property. Approximately 34 acres of irrigated vineyard has now been planted since that time. The land proposed for addition to this preserve will be used to expand the adjacent vineyard. Approximately 30 acres of the added land consists of class 4 soil that is well suited as rangeland. The property qualifies for the program as an addition to existing agricultural preserve and land conservation contract according to the following provision in the rules of procedure. A property owner under contract who acquires adjacent parcels of any size may add this land by amendment of the existing agricultural preserve and contract. The contract amendment is to recognize the remaining term of the original contract, but in no event less than 10 years. The Agricultural Preserve Review Committee and Planning Commission recommend approval with a minimum parcel size of 320 acres and the remaining term of the existing contract, which in this case is approximately 18 and a half years.
Thank you. With no lights on, we'll open it to the public. Seeing no response, close it to the public, bring it back to the board for action.
Mr. Chairman, I move staff recommendation.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Ashajian. And Patterson's getting closer, but he's trying. with that, a roll call vote, please.
Who was my first and second?
It was Mr. Meacham and Mr. Ashajian.
Okay. Mr. Meacham?
Aye.
Mr. Ashajian?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Item E.
Item E is a proposal by Anthony and Maria Busi to establish an agricultural preserve to enable the applicant to enter into a land conservation contract. The project site consists of approximately 186 acres within the agriculture land use category and is located at 3663 Willow Creek Road, approximately 2.5 miles west of Templeton, north of Highway 46. The site is in the Adelaide planning area. The property is currently used for dry farm grain production. The property qualifies for a 100-acre minimum preserve with approximately 145 acres of land with class 4 soils appropriate for dry farm crops. The Agricultural Preserve Review Committee, as well as the Planning Commission, recommend approval with a minimum parcel size of 160 acres and a minimum term of 20 years.
Thank you. open it to the public, and without response, close it to the public, bring it back to the board for action.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Patterson. Very good. And a roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Asaji?
Aye.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Item F.
Item F is a proposal by Lunamata Ranch to establish an agricultural preserve to enable the applicant to enter into a land conservation contract. The project site consists of approximately 247 acres within the agriculture land use category and is located at 5090 Peachy Canyon Road, approximately 4.5 miles west of Paso Robles. The site is in the Adelaida planning area. The property consists of moderately sloping land planted in irrigated vineyard and non-irrigated orchards, as well as rangeland on steeper portions of the site. The property qualifies for an agricultural preserve based on the property's 30 acres of irrigated vineyard, orchards, and the grazing land. The appropriate minimum parcel size for this mixed-use agricultural property is 160 acres. The appropriate term is 20 years. The Agricultural Preserve Review Committee and the Planning Commission recommend approval of this request to establish an agricultural preserve.
Thank you. Open it to the public. Seeing no response, close it to the public. Bring it back to the board for action.
Second.
I think Mr. Shajin's back on form with that second. Madam Clerk, a roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Aye.
Mr. Shajin?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. And our final item, G.
Item G is a proposal by David Levesay to establish an agricultural preserve to enable the applicant to enter into a land conservation contract. The project site consists of approximately 118 acres within the rural lands land use category and is located at 7280 Webster Road, approximately 2 miles southwest of Creston off of Highway 41. The site is in the El Pomar planning area. This property has been used historically as grazing land for cattle. The property qualifies for a 100-acre minimum preserve with approximately 114 acres. of land with class 4 and 6 soils described in the Natural Resource Conservation Service's soil survey as moderately suited as rangeland. The appropriate minimum parcel size for the agricultural preserve is 320 acres based on the rangeland capability, and the appropriate term is 20 years. The Agricultural Preserve Review Committee, as well as the Planning Commission, recommend approval of this request to establish an agricultural preserve. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you. Open it to the public. Seeing no response, close it to the public. Back to the board for action.
I'll move approval of staff's recommendation.
Second. Thank you, Mr. Shajin and Mr. Patterson on the first. And a roll call, please.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mr. Shajin?
Aye.
Mr. Meacham?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. And with that, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we are adjourned.
Oh, no. What do we do with this?